It's Monday, September 13th, and you're instituting new rules on two-thirds of American workers? Good luck with that. We start here. Business leaders and lawmakers react to President Biden's sweeping new vaccination rules.
It's going to drive people out of work, out of hospitals, out of all this stuff.
We'll break down what they mean for you and your workplace. California prepares for a possible governator sequel.
And that person would be the leader of 40 million people, the world's fifth largest economy.
Dramatic polling swings in the final days of this recall race. Our reporter has spoken with both the top candidates. And what makes someone America strong?
It became more than just volunteering. We actually became friends.
In a year of division and devastation, there are still people looking out for their neighbors, even when those neighbors are arriving from the other side of the world. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
This pandemic often feels like one long, unchanging slog. But there are moments, these kind of quantum leaps, in how America changes its approach to the coronavirus. Vaccines were the biggest leap, of course. The CDC saying vaccinated people could stop wearing masks, that was also a big moment. So was the moment the Delta variant forced them to backtrack and say, actually, most Americans should still wear masks indoors.
We've been patient, but our patience is wearing thin.
Well, this past week, when President Biden announced that large companies will be expected to make sure their employees are vaccinated, as bureaucratic as the Department of Labor sounds, that's a big deal. That, along with Biden's measures for federal workers, that equals two-thirds of the American workforce. And throughout the weekend, we saw leaders, public sector, private sector, grappling with this new reality. Let's start off with ABC's Ann Flaherty this week, who covers COVID. And so much reaction to what's being called a vaccine mandate. In some ways, it's almost more of a testing mandate, I was realizing. That's the only bar you have to clear. But can you just break down how this is about to work?
This has never been done before, Brad. This is the first of its kind, a nationwide mandate reaching into the private sector and saying employers have a obligation to keep the workplace safe, saying test or mandate if you have over 100 employees. So if you remember last December, Biden said he wouldn't mandate vaccines.
No, I don't think it should be mandatory. I wouldn't demand to be mandatory, but I would do everything in my power, just like I don't think masks have to be made mandatory nationwide.
I even remember when Dr. Fauci said vaccine mandates would be inappropriate and unenforceable. But as you pointed out, everything has changed. There were two big ones, is that kids started to get sick in unprecedented numbers, and then the economy was starting to sag.
Some of the biggest companies are already requiring this. United Airlines, Disney, Tyson's Food, and even Fox News.
You know, I think President Biden was looking at the polling. 8 in 10 Americans say they've either gotten the vaccination or they're willing to do so. So this is a really small but vocal minority of people who are refusing to get vaccinated. And he's doing it in a really interesting way. He's going through OSHA and the Labor Department, as you mentioned. They have requirements that say you have to make sure that a workplace is safe. So for these companies that have 100 employees or more, they either have to mandate vaccinations or they have to test their employees regularly. Now, how they're going to enforce this is a little bit tricky. It's likely that an employee can file a complaint with the federal government. Then the federal government has to investigate. If they find that that company has violated this regulation, it's going to be about a $14,000 fine that these companies will face.
Is that legal? And like, the reason that companies have to pay taxes is because there's laws that Congress wrote saying you got to pay taxes. Is there a law saying that companies have to make sure their employees are vaccinated or pay for testing for all of them?
No. So there's not a federal law, but this is going to be a federal regulation. We do have state laws on the books that require vaccinations in schools and so forth. That's why the Biden administration thinks that they're on solid ground.
You have to put this in context. There are requirements that we put in workplaces and in schools every day. To make sure that workplaces and schools are safe.
It's going to drive people out of work, out of hospitals, out of all this stuff where you have a need for people.
Now, we've already heard from 19 governors, Republican governors, who say that they're going to fight this in court.
So we live in America, and you would expect words like that from the president, maybe of communist China.
We know that there are going to be lawsuits. The Biden administration says they're not scared in the least.
Mr. President, what is your message to Republicans who are calling your vaccine requirements an overreach, who are threatening to challenge it in court?
Have at it.
They think that they are very solid here, that you can require a safe workplace environment by requiring this testing or vaccination.
These are steps that we take every day that OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, oversees. So this is not an unusual phenomenon. What it is I think, an appropriate response.
I heard a colleague who covers far-right news, far-right websites and everything, the chatter, right, say, through all this, masks, variants, ICU beds, like, you think it has been angry up until now? Nothing has gotten some people as galvanized as this idea of mandates on their own businesses. I'm wondering if the effect that this could have, the backlash that this could yield, is that more trouble than it's worth? Is that proportional to the amount of lives that could be saved?
Well, that's what we don't know, and that all remains to be seen.
I would get another job, or I would totally change industries just to be able to hang on to that personal freedom.
There will definitely be challenges, especially for probably smaller businesses closer to the 100 employees.
I do think you're talking about a very small minority here that is pushing back. But when you see governors like Kay Ivey, who's already blamed the unvaccinated and said it's time to take aim at these people.
These folks are choosing a horrible lifestyle of self-inflicted pain.
But she stood very firm against this mandate. She says this is a perfect example of Washington overreach. As Republicans, we don't agree with federal mandates on this kind of thing. We should only encourage people to get vaccination.
We cannot allow these actions to stand in the way of protecting the large majority of Americans.
But the problem with this, according to the Biden officials, is that it's reached into everyone's lives when hospitals can no longer care for young children who don't have a choice to get vaccinated. And when the economy is starting to sag again, that's a big problem. And I think they're making a political calculation that the majority of Americans are with them on this.
Right. And your point about KIV is such an important one, I think, because if you were living in Alabama and you were unsure about the vaccine, here you had your Republican governor saying, what are you people whining about? Get the vaccine. Make this personal choice. You could see the Biden administration had this ally. Now, from afar, at least, it looks like she is in direct opposition to the Biden administration. So it could look to a lot of people in Alabama like the Biden administration just burned a bridge. Ann Flaherty in Washington. Thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
We knew it would be the biggest political story of the week, but if you look at the star power that's been trotting around California over the last few days, you get the clear sense that the outcome could have way, way bigger implications than just a quirky recall election.
We will not give up because we know that so much is at stake.
Election day for Governor Gavin Newsom's recall is tomorrow, and ABC's Zorin Shaw has been tracking this every step of the way. She's based in LA. And Zorin, the more I think about it, the stranger it is, right? You can get booted from the governor's mansion at any moment. No impeachment required. Voters don't have to wait for the entire length of the term to vote again. And if you get 49% of that recall vote, you can lose to someone with only 20% of the popular vote. Am I getting that all right?
I know, Brad. It's totally wild, right? A lot of people are talking about this, and there's just a lot of political pundits who've been saying maybe this process is unconstitutional.
I'll leave that to constitutional lawyers and pundits. But at the end of the day, look, this is the second recall effort of the last three governors.
If 12% of voters from the last gubernatorial election sign their name that they want the governor recalled, it can make it to the ballot. And so that's exactly what happened this time. We just needed 1.5 million signatures, and they partly got that because of the pandemic. And that brings us to right now.
Why is Joe Biden coming out on Monday to help this recall? Because he recognizes his agenda is at risk in this country.
Larry Elder is polling around 26%. Gavin Newsom is actually polling at about 56%, according to the last poll. So let's just pretend that Newsom gets 49% of the vote tomorrow. That means the next guy who has the most number of votes, in this case, right now it's looking like it would be Larry Elder based on the polling.
One of the first things I'm going to do is repeal the requirement for state workers that they have to be tested once a week and they have to wear masks at work.
He would be in, and that person would be the leader of 40 million people, the world's fifth largest economy. And again, Brad, like in a one-to-one matchup, it's really hard for a Republican in this state, the bastion of liberalism, one of the bluest states in the whole country, to win. But it could very well happen tomorrow.
Well, and so what's been happening then in the closing weekend of this race? What have you been seeing?
Newsom is going all out. I mean, he's sparing nothing. They have spent tens of millions of dollars to try to keep his seat.
Hello, Californians. You've got a big choice to make by September 14th.
Biden is campaigning for him tomorrow. Vice President Kamala Harris, Warren, Klobuchar, they all came out for him.
The leading opponent here, Larry Elder, has already said that if he gets the chance, he will replace any Democratic California senator with a Republican. He'll do that by appointment.
The margins are just getting a lot wider. The 538 average has him at about 52%. That's enough for him to keep his job. And Larry Elder, you know, at 26%, still far more than the rest, clear double-digit lead. And then you have the rest, Caitlyn Jenner, close to 1%, and the rest all somewhere kind of in between or not even making 1%.
But so that I'm wondering then, Zareen, is it easier? So Gavin Newsom is, if you ask the average Californian, they'd rather have him in office. But if next is Larry Elder, is it easier for Newsom to run against a person now instead of just the concept, the yes or no of should this guy be recalled? Because I feel like the Newsom campaign is framing this now as Gavin Newsom versus Larry Elder. I also wonder, though, if that kind of elevates this guy who has essentially just been a radio host for the last several years.
You know, Brad, I think Newsom's campaign really actually prefers just going against one person versus just making the sole case for Newsom himself. Larry Elder is described by many Democrats as being to the right of Donald Trump. He does not have that widespread support. And that makes it easier for a campaign like Newsom's to target just one person rather than all 46 candidates.
When asked about that reparations bill, Larry Elder went so far as to say, well, if we're going to debate reparations, why aren't we considering paying reparations to slave owners?
The reason I'm running is because of the rise in crime, the rise in homelessness. The fact that this guy doesn't have a clue about what to do about that.
I actually spoke to Larry Elder in a very rare one-on-one interview just over this weekend, and I asked him over and over again, would you accept the results of Tuesday's election?
Do you agree to accept the results of this election?
You know, I find it a fascinating question when people ask me that. No one ever asked my opponent, did he agree with Hillary when she refused to accept the results of the 2016 election?
Finally, he just kept saying, you know, so many people are going to vote to have it recalled. I'm not worried about fraud. Let's read between the lines here. Elder sure seems to be saying that as long as the governor's recalled, the election is legitimate. But if Newsom is not recalled, which is the very likely outcome, again, because of all the polling that we're seeing, that's somehow evidence of fraud. So Tuesday night is going to be really interesting. But again, it could take a few days for all these results to come in. So we'll just kind of see what happens.
Well, and Hillary Clinton did accept the results of the election, right? She waited a night, then she called her opponent and conceded defeat. That was the precedent that was broken under former President Trump. So we'll see how this works out this week. Zareen Shah, tracking it all in California. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, she's welcoming Afghan refugees deep to the heart of Texas. We're back in a bit. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Have you ever wondered what you would do with an extra hour in your day? I think about this all the time. I'm like, I would be so productive. I'd exercise more, or I'd read a book, or I'd take a nap, like restore myself. We often find ourselves yearning for these extra hours, but the real question is, what would you do if you were making yourself a priority? Well, how about therapy? It can help you discover what's important so you can make the most of your time. If you've ever benefited from therapy, you know how transformative it can be. It's not just for those who have experienced major trauma. Therapy empowers you to learn positive coping skills, set boundaries, and become the best version of yourself. If you're considering starting therapy, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and tailored to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire. You'll be matched with a licensed therapist. And here's the beauty of it. You can switch therapists if you're not finding the right fit. No additional charge. Take the first step. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/start here today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P
mintmobile.com/start here. We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there should be no compromise. Don't go back to that one doctor, you know the type, like I've had this person before, that doesn't actually listen to you or who seems just in a rush to end your appointment that you spent months making. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable, listen to you, and prioritize your health. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. You can search by location, availability, and insurance. So no compromises here, because with ZocDoc, you got more options than you know. We're talking about booking appointments with tens of thousands of top-rated, patient-reviewed, credible doctors and specialists. Go to ZocDoc.com/start here and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc, ZocDoc.com/start here. ZocDoc.com/start here. We spent much of the last week remembering the tragedy of September 11th, 2001, and this weekend, I think a lot of us thought about what America looked like on September 12th.
The days that followed September 11th, 2001, we saw heroism everywhere, a true sense of national unity.
There was this sense of not just a shared sense of purpose, a shared sense of sadness, but a shared sense of identity. On September 12th, 20 years ago, there was this distinct, palpable feeling of, we're all Americans. We've all been attacked. New York is America. Washington is America. Shanksville, Pennsylvania, it's all America.
The anniversary for me, it's taken me 20 years, but I'm finally at a place where I celebrate my father.
And in the days since, of course, we've seen divisions, but also so much resilience. Think of what we've been through in the last 2 decades, what we've been through in the last year. So for the rest of this month, across ABC News, we're going to be shining a spotlight on Americans who are doing whatever they can in their own way to help their neighbors. We're calling this series America Strong, and it starts with someone dropping everything to help perhaps their newest neighbors. Cassie Stewart is a volunteer with Refugee Services of Texas outside Dallas. Cassie, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
So when we hear about the mass evacuations from Afghanistan, the biggest American airlift in history, what I think it's missed is how that's just the beginning of the work, right? What's done next is not only by the military, it's not just the State Department, but regular folks like yourself are actually helping refugees get situated there in Texas, right? So have people started showing up from Afghanistan yet?
They have. Yes, they have. They've traveled far. They're coming to a new place. We want to help them feel as comfortable as they can when they arrive and just have, you know, everything they need to start living. Mm. We like to try to get ages of the kids and set up beds and maybe even have some toys or activities.
Most of them come with literally nothing. When we talk about the shirts on their backs, we mean that.
I was lucky that I left Afghanistan because I work with Americans. I was worried about my situation, my family.
Many of them just, you know, go to sometimes a house, but most of the times an apartment. They're not going to feel at home, but at least they can have some basic necessities, you know, when they arrive.
A family uprooted from Afghanistan, Farmars Fakhouri, is deserving of every bit of American life. A translator who helped the American Army and Air Force with Farsi for nearly 8 years.
Our feeling was that how much we are blessed from God. We didn't know that.
This particular family that we've been working with, that we just finished setting up an apartment for, when we went to visit them in their apartment and see what they needed, there was a bit of a language barrier, of course, but we were able to just look around and communicate the best way we could on what it is they needed. For their one-year-old, you know, needed a stroller, they needed some beds, they needed many apartment things that we were able to communicate with them and start getting. And I soon found out that I was taking on a little bit more than I could handle. And a couple of those volunteers happened to speak a language very close to the language of this Afghan family.
Oh, I was going to ask if they're not speaking English. Yeah. How do you overcome that?
Yeah. So a lot of hand motions and pointing and whatnot. But again, it was super, super helpful to have these two women who speak Farsi, which is very similar to Dari, which is what this family spoke.
My sister applied to some embassies, but they rejected because no country is issuing visa to Afghans right now.
And, you know, there are just some things like dealing with, you know, registering for school or just really trying to figure out, you know, if I can't really understand what the mom is asking for, then I can, give somebody a call and we can figure it out.
And how big is the family, you said? Can you just tell me a little bit more about the family and what they're like?
A family of five, three kids, and a mom and a dad. Definitely a special immigrant visa family. And it was really great because at one point we were sitting on the floor of his apartment and he was showing me all of his certificates. He was quite a skilled electrician in Afghanistan. Hmm. And he was showing me all of his certificates and really hoping that he would be able to find something over here in that line of work. I can't even imagine what it would be like to have fled and be thrown into a new place. And it just takes a lot of people to help.
Well, and that's my other question is why do this? like this sounds so daunting and so literally foreign. What made you personally want to get involved with something like this?
Yeah, so about 6 years ago or so, watching the news about the Syrian refugee crisis, seeing things on the news.
When you see the danger hundreds of thousands have faced, you might wonder, how can parents risk it all with their children? Well, they told me that Syria is simply far worse, far more dangerous.
I really felt a pull toward displaced people. Mm. My husband is an immigration attorney, and I did not know the first thing about refugees. Even with him as an immigration attorney, I didn't know much at all. Mm. But I knew I wanted to do something. And I gave Refugee Services of Texas a call on the phone. I was able to speak to the volunteer coordinator who said, here's our list of donations, and here's the date of our next training. And I went to that two-hour training and learned more about refugees than I had ever learned in my entire life. And it pulled me even closer to wanting to do that kind of work. I was able to take my little kids who were 12 and under to volunteer with me. We first started by watching the kids of refugee moms who were taking English classes, because that's something that they're all supposed to do, is to take English classes when they arrive.
Oh, and they need childcare when they're doing that.
They do, right. And, you know, we became friends with one of the refugee families, and we went to their home and they served us food, and it became more than just volunteering. We actually became friends. Shortly after, you know, getting to really know them, the mother had an unfortunate incident. She tried to take her own life and found herself in the hospital. And I think that was a real shift in my empathy for refugees. I really started to maybe understand just a tiny bit the trauma and the challenges that they face.
We had no other choice, so we have to leave.
It was very scary trying to escape from the Taliban. We got the news and they just told us to get out of our house. So we just put on some clothes and ran and came to the airport.
And I just knew that I wanted to be a part of helping and, you know, get the community and the interfaith community as well a part of, you know, helping make their life a little bit easier. One of my volunteers took the 12-year-old to his first day of school today.
Oh.
Very brave little boys going into a brand new school. And, you know, honestly, we can get them set up as best we can.
Everybody's so friendly, helping. Everybody's here to help.
And my hope is that one of us stays in contact. When I was at their apartment and I was getting ready to leave, the mom, you know, had me sit down and she served me some of her special tea. And I hope that there's more than just a desire to give things, but to sit and become friends and to open up mm-hmm. our lives and they can open up their lives. And maybe we can make some friends along the way.
It's so valuable, I think, to remember that this is not a process that just happens, right? When we thought of Americans getting help in Afghanistan over the years, that didn't just happen. There were real people risking their lives to help us. And now, regular people like you trying to give them some kind of life looking forward as a new neighbor and as a new friend. Cassie Stewart, there in Texas. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We're going to take one more quick break. When we return, Congress wants to make your next car cheaper. Guess what? There are some strings attached. One last thing is next.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Thank you.
And one last thing, something to keep your eye on. This is the week when House Democrats will really hammer out the specifics of this enormous spending bill they're eventually hoping to pass with 50 votes in the Senate, which means you're about to see a ton of little fights about very specific measures, which say a lot about the direction of both parties.
And if anyone's going to, you know, move these fantastic pickup truck customers who are very open to technology over to electric, it'll be Ford.
For example, this week, the House Ways and Means Committee is going to consider new tax incentives for electric vehicles. This is not just a small little push. This would potentially save car buyers $12,000 on a new electric car, but it only kicks in if your electric car was made by union workers.
When I hear climate, I think jobs. Good paying union jobs.
That's the stipulation, and that is great news for Detroit. Ford, GM, and Chrysler, they're all union shops. But there are lots of electric cars in this country not made by union workers. Toyota, Honda, and Tesla have tons of U.S. plants. They employ American workers, but they're not unionized. Coincidentally or not, a lot of those plants are also in red states like Alabama, Kentucky, Indiana. Honda is loudly asking Democratic lawmakers, wait, so you're saying you're willing to subvert your big climate priorities and limit how many customers actually buy electric just to help out the big unions who supply you votes? Democrats say part of rebuilding the U.S. will involve rebuilding unions. This bill could effectively put a 30% off sale tag on a lot of these union-made vehicles, which in their minds means you can have your zero-emission cake and eat it too. Fascinating little wrinkles here. That's up for a committee vote tomorrow. We're going to keep digging into all the little nooks and crannies of this bill. Hey, if you're enjoying the show, maybe you just discovered us, maybe you're a Start Here OG, hit us up with a rating and review. 5 stars is our favorite. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table.
What is happening here?
It's just beautiful chaos.
Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view.
To be honest, I was thinking about asking him for a foot massage, and then I just froze.
This is the best gig on TV.
And you know, anything can happen.
That is what we do here.
I'm not going to lie, the chair's a little small for my behind.
The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.